in a scathing and carrots and ice cream. That'll have to do it for today's show. That was a lot of fun. I think I am going to have to do a follow-up on Icelandic jazz someday, because I found a whole lot of other stuff that I really liked and just couldn't quite fit on today's program. Anyway, you've been listening to Dark Glasses on CFRC 101.9 with Daniel Wolf. I'll be back next week with more music. Meantime, keep warm or cool as the weather demands, and stay safe.
Now I wear my sunglasses tonight, so I can keep track of the visions in my eyes. While she's deceiving me, it cuts my security as she's in control of me. I turn to her and say, don't you blame the guy in chains, oh no.
The guy in chains, the guy in chains, oh no.
Don't masquerade with the guy in chains, oh no.
We can't believe it,
cause you've got it made with the guy in chains, oh no.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic. Every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
They don't tell you how. So out of nowhere, I'm like clenching up my fist, and I'm like, no countdown. And then they were like, that is the most chill anyone has ever been, because they're like, a lot of people like scream and stuff or like do something else. And I'm like, okay, that's good to know.
That's Adele, the one talking about the screaming, about clenching fists, about pain. That's what they felt when they got an IUD or intrauterine device inserted into their cervix. An IUD is a T-shaped device, and it's about an inch and a half wide. Now, I'm a Gen X woman. We barely used IUDs. They were out of fashion for a while when I was growing up. We used the pill or we used condoms. I first learned about the comeback of IUDs through my son. His girlfriend used them, and as it turned out, almost all their friends used them too. But nobody told me about the pain. Not until I met Mia Johnson, our journalism fellow, who sent me the story pitch that you're going to hear today. Now, new regulations came out in the U.S. back in August about managing this pain. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have said before anyone gets an IUD, patients should be counseled on pain management ahead of time. But what about Canada? Why are so many people still suffering the pain? Mia Johnson is here to answer that. Wait for it.
How do you know to stop when you're putting it through?
Well, that's right. You look. Take a look. Where are you? Can you see the cervix?
Yes.
Great. So, steady your speculum.
This?
Good.
Is the sound of the speculum. It's sort of a plastic tube. It's shaped kind of like a duck's beak. There's a small lever to push it open and lock it in place. General practitioners or gynecologists use the speculum to get a better look, to aim their metal instruments in the cervix during a pap smear or a cervical procedure. And the speculum can look pretty frightening.
I like these ones because they're transparent. The metal ones look even more archaic, so patients really get scared.
I'm in a small exam room with no windows. I'm trying to get a better view of this pelvis.
Do you do
X-ray?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it only, do you push it until you can see properly?
Yeah.
Okay.
A fake pelvis, though, not a real one. I'm not a doctor, I'm a journalist. Let's be clear here, I'm not using the speculum on a real patient.
Okay. You don't need a license for this because it's a model.
Yeah.
Right? Occasionally I've had learners, they cut one, and then as they pull it, of course they pulled IUDL.
This is all just part of the process. I'm learning how to insert an IUD, or trying to. A lot of emphasis on trying.
Take a look, because you're pulling her, you're going to give her a hysterectomy, my
friend. Oh, God.
Yeah, good.
Dr. Paisa Rezaifa is obviously the expert here, not me. She's been inserting IUDs for 18 years. She's got a steady hand, a necessary qualification for someone doing this kind of work.
You see, I cut it, right? Yeah. I'm not even seated, am I?
No, did you're I not. Cut it? You didn't even look. You're holding a microphone, too.
Yeah.
Wow.
I could even have my eyes closed. No, just kidding. Right? There you go.
She's also got a wicked sense of humor.
And when I travel for teaching my husband, sometimes I go very nice places. And I said, you want to come with me? He says, not in a million years. You and all your vaginas traveling together. You know, he's horrified. Says, can you imagine if they decide to open up your
never happened.
Luggage?
Just an airport,
you know? Well, actually, once they did, because I was carrying a bunch of Volvo models.
She's standing behind me, steadying my hand. Unlike hers, mine is shaking a bit, trying to hold on to this long plastic applicator that's attached to the IUD.
Push, push, push. Yeah, hard. Good. Keep going.
Now, in a real procedure, this is the moment where the patient can feel a lot of discomfort. And who can blame them? I'm shoving 12 and a half inches of plastic tubing where it does not belong. The cervix is about an inch in diameter, and nothing ever goes up it, really. It's not something that's supposed to happen. And any manipulation of the cervix, that tends to feel pretty crampy. So imagine if you're in labor and your cervix is dilating and things are pushing on it. What's happening here is like that, but on a micro scale. And the cervix has got a lot of sensory nerve endings, meaning it's likely this is about to hurt like a
okay. And she's getting real impatient now. She's like, ow, am I done? Keep going.
Still?
Yes. So now you're against the cervix, right?
Okay.
Okay, good.
Okay.
And you've...
I came to the Ottawa Newcomer Clinic, where Dr. Rezaifa spends half of her week. So why am I playing doctor on this mannequin? Well, if I could understand the steps of the procedure, maybe I could figure out how something like this could be causing people so much pain. I'm trying to understand women's pain, because I'm trying to understand why, for some people, this sucks so much. Because supposedly there's some level of pain management for this kind of thing. I mean, it's 2024. There's oral painkillers, cervical anesthesia, a numbing spray, laughing gas, or in extreme cases, even sedation. Now, if it's common knowledge that this is a thing that hurts, and some doctors are offering options to manage pain, why aren't more doctors doing this?
So like... The first time someone told me about an IUD, I somehow misheard where it was placed. I somehow heard that it gets placed in your forearm. I'm not like a scientist, you know? Like, this is just how women work, right? Like, I was told by a woman, so it must be true.
More people are starting to talk about IUDs. When I would tell people about this story, it seemed like everybody I spoke to had something to say about them. Like my friend James, who you just heard, on my road trip to Ottawa to see Dr. Rezaifa.
I was talking with my sister about it, and she was talking about IUDs, and I was like, yeah, they're super invasive. I can't believe it goes in your arm or something. And she looked at me like, what are you talking about? James, no. Of course, that's not where it goes. I forget where exactly it's inserted, you know? What is it, like uterus?
Yeah. Up your cervix.
Cervix.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So the IUD goes up your cervix, and the switch to turn on and off is on your forearm.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
it's actually a A lot of people don't know what IUDs are or what they're used for, or like James, where they go.
Doctors aren't sure yet how the IUD works, but for many people, the IUD is the best.
This is from a 1967 sexual education video called To Plan Your Family. And as you can imagine now, doctors do know how IUDs work.
It's certainly the least expensive and the least trouble. Some women have discomfort or cramps for the first few hours or days. However, once the body gets used to the IUD, few people have any trouble. It can be left in for years.
IUDs are still one of the most fail-safe forms of birth control. More and more Canadians are relying on IUDs. A survey conducted by researchers at the University of Ottawa found that between 2006 and 2016, their popularity among Canadian women had doubled, with nearly 9% of contraception users citing IUDs as their go-to method. 9 may seem like a small number, but that's a big shift from what it used to be. Early IUDs were found to have major issues after they were put on the market.
This important health warning is for women still using the Dalcon Shield, an IUD birth control device obtained in the early to mid-1970s. There is substantial medical opinion that continued use of the Dalcon Shield may pose a serious personal health hazard, and it should be removed. It's that important.
The Dalcon Shield IUD. It was pulled from the Canadian market in 1974 after it was discovered that an ill-designed removal string would funnel bacteria into the uterus. The Dalcon Shield caused serious medical consequences, like pelvic inflammatory disease, miscarriage, loss of fertility, and even death. News reports from the time say hundreds of thousands of lawsuits were filed against A.H. Robbins, the manufacturer of the Dalcon Shield IUD. The Dalcon debacle seriously scarred the IUD's reputation in the 70s, but IUDs have a much longer history than that. IUDs have been around since 1909. Dr. Richard Richter came up with the first design. A ring made of silkworm guts would be placed in the uterus. Silkworm guts look kind of like little tiny white strings, but just slimier. In the 1920s, Ernst Grafenberg attached a silver wire to that ring. The man who they named the G-spot after for all his research on female anatomy. Yeah, you heard that right. That elusive center of female pleasure, the G-spot, is actually Ernst Grafenberg. Sounds sexy. Okay, sidebar over. This model wasn't exactly safe either. Early models like these were condemned for their ineffectiveness, their potential for infection and irritation. Then the 1960s brought the Maysland spring, which the U.S. Food and Drug Administration recalled for dangerous complications. Anyways, you get the gist, so it's no surprise that we would be skeptical. And on top of that, just having something in your body that you can't check on, that you can't see, is scary. Now, IUDs are safe. They're very safe. But their insertion is still not guaranteed to be pain-free by any extent. People get IUDs for all sorts of reasons, not only as a form of birth control. When I asked Dr. Rezaifa why someone would want an IUD, this is what she said.
I truly believe that misogyny has turned our reproductive health system into a taboo that is used only for sex and reproduction. Right, many people who have a uterus nowadays decide to not have sex or not have children, but they still have a uterus that is causing them tremendous pain and agony and bleed, and they need that IUD. So can we talk about that?
I mean, it is also the most unsexy thing in the entire world. You can like feel it, like you can feel the like strings and you're like, oh man, or not like the strings. Mine are more like plastic little antennas.
That's Adele again, who we heard at the top of the show. They got their IUD back in April because of their endometriosis, a debilitating disease that causes chronic pain. Endometriosis is what happens when the tissue on the lining of your uterus grows on the outside. Then during your period, that tissue sheds into your abdomen. Adele described it as an electrical pain or a stabbing pain, accompanied by body aches that would come with having the flu or something like COVID. And so the IUD would hopefully relieve that pelvic pain coming from the endometrial tissue.
How's your IUD?
So my IUD is finally, I think, kicked in. So after we talked, I noticed a lot of like significant improvements in all of my flare-ups, which is great.
Wow,
like
okay.
I haven't had.
But to get the IUD, that was painful in itself.
And yeah, the IUD was. I mean, that was an experience.
Having met Adele soon after they got their IUD, they had a very clear memory of what it felt like.
They're like, how are you going to cope with the pain afterwards? And I'm like, I'm going to smoke a bunch of weed. Or I'm going to have, like, and I should have taken a, like, edible beforehand. So I could have just, like, zoned out. And, like, that's how I could have dealt with, like, that pain. But, yeah, oof.
We ran into each other at the library when I was doing research for this story. They were working at the information desk, and we just hit it off right away.
If I remember correctly, my colleague was switching off for lunch, and so I said that.
Yeah, right. I was talking to someone completely different.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, I think I know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And then you stepped in.
Yeah. And I went back going, that was awesome. And we just talked about it. And so it's just like kismet sometimes where you're like, oh, like, that's so cool. What wild timing. Because I was going off to my, like, appointment literally an hour later.
Mm-hmm. What are the chances of me running into someone who is actually on her way to the doctor to have her IUD checked? Well, it turns out the chances are pretty good, at least on that day. Like I said, it kept happening. Everyone I met knew somebody with an IUD or had one themselves.
You will feel cramping. And I forget if it's then or after it gets like put in, but I just remember my uterus went into like the fetal position and was like, why are you doing this to us? Like, this is not fun.
This is hard to hear. It reminds me how I felt when I got my IUD back in January of this year. I don't remember every step. It was all a blur. It was all bad. But what I do remember is 5 or 10 minutes afterwards sitting in the office. Not able to get up after the doctor had walked out of the room. And feeling embarrassed and exposed and needing my mom.
I think I took like a Klonopin too because I'm like, I just need to like, just the pain was. Yes. It ramped down, but my body knew that something was wrong.
On the car ride home, my mom told me, and I remember her vividly telling me this, it sounds like you're in labor. From the way I was groaning, every time the car hit a bump, it felt like I was reliving the procedure over again.
Yes. Like, something's different, and like, I could feel it. That's the only way to like describe it. And I'm like, I don't know how to get this go away. But it took about like, I felt like it took about like a week for my body to be like, oh, okay, this is here. It's not killing us, so we can like, we're fine with it. But yeah, like I felt it for like a week.
That's why I took up this story. I had my own experience and I wanted an answer as to how this happened. The thing about pain is that it's individual. It's personal.
I knew some people that had it, and I'm like, it's not that bad.
See, you rolling your eyes.
I mean. Like, it's not fun.
Yeah.
Remember how I told you that everyone I spoke to had something to say about this story? Well, my friend Mariana Schwetze happened to get her IUD at the same time I was reporting on this. So I did the pain-in-the-ass journalism thing and begged her to take me along.
The thoughts in my brain before the procedure is like Inquisition, morgue, vibrator.
Happy thoughts.
No, but I'm fine. See, imagine you're by yourself here, but alone, just looking at the ceiling. That's the part I hate. Because now I'm naked, vulnerable. My phone is, I don't know where. And then if you're not here, if no one's here with me, a friend, my mom, or a partner, or someone, I'm just here by myself in my own anxiety, looking at this ugly ceiling.
Mariana, who you heard right before the break, had a very different experience than mine.
At least it's quick. I feel like this is better than the other time. I feel like I was more scared, you know?
You can kind of scooch back up.
Okay.
She was uncomfortable, but the pain wasn't excruciating. It wasn't like my own experience, and it wasn't like Adele's. But maybe that's the problem.
You know, I feel like it's different by woman to woman or person to person. And like, yeah, but how does that help me? What do I do? It's like, you power through it. Like fun.
It's not consistent. Pain isn't consistent. So how do we regulate pain management in this procedure when it comes down to our own individual expectations? The U.S. just updated their guideline in August. It recommends that physicians and gynecologists counsel patients about what options are available to them ahead of the procedure. They've also said misoprostol, a medication used for dilating the cervix, isn't recommended for standard use anymore. So in Canada, what's the direction at a federal level? Well, the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists released a statement in 2022 noting ways to manage pain and advising counseling in advance. How are these guidelines enforceable? Because in practice, this is what I'm hearing from the people I talk to.
Yeah, I was given no pain options. They just told me to take these meds that weren't working to begin with.
I mean, I took the two Advils, so I guess I was as prepared as I could have been, but not aware, I guess, of the potential pain that was coming.
He's like, you can take an Advil, you can listen to music. He literally told me to listen to Spotify. Yeah, just put on your favorite song. I was so shocked. Yeah, just listen to music while someone's yanking open your cervix, like, all chill, no big deal. Yep, I will not be going back to that doctor.
I had a lot of questions for the provincial government, but no one, not the Ministry of Health, not Ontario Health, not the Office of the Health Minister, have responded yet. So I went to Planned Parenthood looking for answers, and I spoke with Dr. Allison Rawson. She says a lot of physicians in Canada completed their training at a time when there was less advanced understanding of how to manage the pain of IUD insertions. Again, this is not all doctors. In Dr. Rawson's experience, the providers offering the largest selection of pain management options out there are the ones who actively seek them out, or even bear the brunt of the cost.
We're just finishing up this little podcast.
Oh, fun. Are you a preceptor for a student?
You know what? This is interesting. Why don't you come tell them what you're doing?
Okay.
Why don't you come and tell them?
That's Dr. Rezaifa again. Okay. Remember when I was cosplaying as a gynecologist on a fake pelvis? Well, we're standing in the waiting room of the clinic now.
It's about pain management during IUD insertion. The podcast is about that.
Actually, I have a question.
She called me over while she was talking with the nurse practitioner, who works at the clinic with her. By stroke of luck, she had just been to a conference where they talked about pain management during IUD insertions.
So I just went to a presentation
and
they were recommending to use the spray. Do you use the spray?
What spray?
Like as if you were doing like a lidocaine spray.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So essentially there are two things that we use that is a bit different from everybody else.
Okay.
So number one is lidocaine jelly, EMLA.
Okay.
It's $11 per hit, let's say. And so you,
Dr. Rezaifa is talking about the cost of lidocaine, a local anesthetic that numbs the cervix by using a spray, cream, or an injection. 5 grams of lidocaine are how much the doctor needs to insert the IUD, costs $11. And there are other pain options too, like Penthrox, which works like laughing gas, but that's also expensive. It costs $55.
That's actually quite expensive. They do get rejected quite often. It's becoming hard to run a clinic and pay for all your overhead because our payment methods have not changed.
In Ontario, hormonal IUDs are covered by OHIP Plus. They're also covered by other government plans like Trillium, Ontario Works, or more. And insertion and removal fees are also covered by OHIP. Each procedure must be billed, and each clinic runs as its own business. So when they're billing additional expenses like lidocaine, Dr. Rezaifa says sometimes these claims get rejected. I reached out to the Ministry of Health for comment on this, and they did not respond.
Just think about how often you have to just go back and forth correcting a bill. More often than not, when they get rejected, doctors don't even bother going after it, right? So, like, think about you doing your work and not getting paid.
I want to catch you up. I set out to work on this story because I wanted to figure out why there aren't more doctors offering things like lidocaine. And from what I understand so far is that, one, pain is personal. It's hard to anticipate how painful it will actually be. Two, a lot of patients are unaware that it's an option, and a lot of physicians are not comfortable offering it. And three, because our legislation doesn't enforce these practices. But there's one last thing I want to talk about. It's our cultural experiences of pain. Dr. Rezaifa has not only practiced in Ottawa. 20 years ago, she worked in Iqaluit.
And then I would go once a month, and I would stay for a couple of days. And I would see patients that the nurses had kind of triaged to see me. So if somebody needed an IUD, they'd have to wait until I go up. Mm-hmm. The majority of births that I attended happened completely naturally, mm-hmm. with no anesthetic, right? Mm-hmm. Incredibly humbling to see. So putting an IUD in for them was a joke, at least the patients I served.
And now, she's splitting her time between consulting at a teaching center and practicing at the Ottawa Newcomer Clinic. And she sees a real difference.
So most of the patients I see here, they have nothing. We give them nothing.
Yeah. Right?
At the Ottawa Newcomer Clinic, Dr. Rezaifa sees government-sponsored refugees in their first year in Canada.
Often, they've had so many children, and even their vaginal delivery, they didn't receive any care. Mm-hmm. They've delivered in war zones and in Afghanistan, Pakistan, refugee centers, wherever. Mm-hmm. So I think their pain tolerance is extremely high.
Yeah.
And so when I offer pain medication to them, they kind of laugh at me. I'd like to think of myself as a stoic. Like, I don't dwell at all over the pain or the health concerns that I've had.
Yeah.
Dr. Rezaifa knows what an IUD feels like firsthand. She's also had procedures on her cervix before, all with no pain management. She's put IUDs in thousands of women. Thousands of vulnerable women put their trust in her while they lay naked and alone on a table.
Unless you've had your own IUD, then you don't know how painful it is, right? And then you're like, holy crow, I can't believe I didn't give more option to people. Because the other thing that we do is we undermine each other's experience, don't we? And I did. I undermined my own experience, and, you know, and I thought, oh, I'm just being too fussy. And then the second IUD, and then the third one, and then I realized, no, this is more than that, right? Because my pelvis was bare and in the hands of someone else.
It's ironic that a procedure meant to give autonomy to people occasionally takes it away.
Once that speculum goes in, they can't move. It's terrible.
something's in your vagina. They can't run away. They're pinned down, literally. And can you imagine? I'm about to put the IUD in, and I do say, I'm almost done. That's a horrible thing we say to patients. They don't care. It feels like it's been hours, right? That 5 minutes.
I've spent 4 months working on this story. I've talked to so many people about the most intimate and personal details of their lives. I've even sat in the room during my friend's IUD insertion. I've spoken to countless physicians, gynecologists, to try to get an answer to the question I posed at the beginning of this story. Why are people still in so much pain over a procedure we've done thousands of times, on thousands of people? And if there are ways to minimize this pain, why aren't we using them? And the answer I've come up with is that we've accepted this pain as part of the process, as part of this procedure, as something we just have to deal with. Dr. Rezaifa is a sadly rare example of a physician providing this kind of reproductive health care today. One of few who empower their patients to make choices for the care of their own bodies.
We're unkind to people who ask for what they need as a society. If those people are women, that's our socialization, right? From very early on, you know, don't be a little girl. Don't cry like a little girl. How often we say that to our children. So we don't want to act like that. And so then we take on the suffering. And that's where we have a lot of work to do.
That's your Canada Land. This episode was brought to you by Carolyn Toff, Maria Elisa Maltese, and Moira Peters. If you value this podcast, please support us. We rely on listeners like you paying for journalism. But more than that, we require your support to help fund our efforts to ensure that great independent journalism in this country can flourish. Today's episode was reported by Mia Johnson, who is part of our first cohort of Canada Lab's Audio Journalism Fellows. She spent the summer reporting this piece with the supporting mentorship of our entire editorial staff. We are so delighted to offer opportunities for great emerging journalists like Mia to learn and to have their work showcased. I'm Karen Pugliese, CanadaLand's editor-in-chief. You can email me at karen@canadaland.com. Our website is canadaland.com. Today's show was reported by Mia Johnson. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capaccioni. Max Collins is our production manager. Theme music by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Hello, my name is Emilie Nicolas, and welcome to Shortcuts. This week I'm joined by scholar and writer Riley Yesno. Hi, Riley.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. This week we ask, can TV save a language? APTN says yes in 18 different languages. And yes, we'll discuss what El Canada's editorial show tell us about the future of Canadian media. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
September, APTN is launching APTN Languages, a brand new channel dedicated to programs in Indigenous languages.
The channel's September schedule will bring programming in 18 Indigenous languages. The schedule begins with Atlantic region languages like Mi'kmaq, then heads north with programming in Innu and Inuktitut. It continues to the prairies with Anishinaabemowin, Cree, and Diné, and ends with West Coast languages like Salishan.
On September 1, 1999, APTN launched its national broadcast and became the first national Indigenous broadcaster in the world. 25 years later, on September 1, 2024, APTN announced some changes to its programming. Its four channels, APTN East, West, North, and HD, are now to be consolidated into two channels, APTN and APTN Languages. And APTN Languages will feature programming in 18 different Indigenous languages with subtitles in French and English. Riley, this news from APTN seems like a big deal for the preservation of Indigenous languages, for their revival, their revitalization. Will you be tuning in to this new channel? How do you think it's going to make APTN a bigger part in your life, first of all, and then on other people's lives as well?
I think I will. I think I will tune in. I mean, I don't have cable, so that's always the problem. But
well, you get cable for that.
Maybe. I mean, if I was going to, because the thing is, I find myself in a position, like I think a lot of younger Indigenous people, where I'm trying to learn the language. And I've done a bunch of different ways of trying to do this. I've like taken university courses and free programs and tried all of these different ways. But if you talk to anybody who's trying to learn a second language, one of the pieces of advice they'll give you is like, just go and watch movies in that language. Go and listen to the news in that language or YouTube videos. And it's really difficult to find those sorts of resources in Indigenous languages. And so for me, that's where this is like really exciting, as just to be able to have a constant stream of language happening in the background, talking about things that are happening on the day to day. That's something that hasn't, for me at least, existed before, and where I think this is like huge.
So it's a tool essentially for people learning the language, not just, you know, TV at this point. It's become part of an educational program, although the programming itself can be anything, including entertainment.
For me, it's a language learning thing. But then also, like, I know in my home community on the res, for example, and a lot of like smaller remote communities like it, the way that we consume the media is different than it is maybe, say, in Canada's largest cities. Like the radio still is like one of the largest ways that people communicate and get news. And so part of the reason they do that is because there's a huge population of people who speak native languages as their first language, and then English is their second language. And so to have native folks on the radio makes it easier to listen. And so having a resource like this, I think, fills actually a really big gap for places like communities like mine, where English is still the second language, and we forget that very often.
It's interesting as well that there's even a way in which the programming is scheduled that fits the different time zones in this country. And so everything has been thought through in that way. But there's also concerns perhaps for some people who were used to, for example, have a specific channel for APTN North that would mostly feature Inuktitut programming, or programming that is about the Inuit communities. And so that's not necessarily going to be the case anymore as things are being integrated differently. There's a shift in strategy there. What do you think of the shift in terms of, from a media executive standpoint, like what is the bigger vision behind such a shift?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unfortunate to me that the answer couldn't be more, you know, like that we can't have both, that we couldn't have the regional approach,
right,
and then also have those in Indigenous languages. But I understand that to already create this whole second channel is something that is certainly going to cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
If I was an exec, I imagine I'd be thinking about, I think there is a pathway for this to be profitable because of the demographics that I just mentioned that I think will find this really useful. But more than anything, I think that this is supposed to respond to very specific calls, for example, from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I would say that they're probably trying to also hit on these larger social and political goals that APTN has been tasked with. And hopefully through there, you can also receive more government funding for meeting some of those calls. It's wild to me, though, as I'm saying this, that like the TRC see is turning 10 years old, you know, next year, and that it's taken 10 years to get somewhere like this, long overdue. And perhaps that's why it's happening now.
And there's been a change in leadership in APTN since over the past 25 years, but also in the recent years. A lot of people are seeing a shift in terms of their strategies, in terms of whether you prioritize growth and trying to reach non-Indigenous audiences, for example, and have that as a target in terms of how you schedule your programming, or do you really focus on servicing the communities? And it seems that what you're saying is that even the fact that maybe this approach that is language focused is not necessarily a revenue-centric approach, let's put it this way, that maybe it should be, and that it depends on basically how the ecosystem is built, and that if there was a production ecosystem that actually valued Indigenous language production, then it would become profitable to actually have a channel that's built this way.
I think for APTN, I don't know for sure, but it seems to me from an outside perspective that every time they've tried to broaden who would be their viewership and get non-Indigenous people in, that it hasn't been that successful. I think of some programming from a couple years back. Maybe the big infamous one amongst Indigenous communities was like First Contact, where they had a series of like non-Indigenous people who were basically self-proclaimed racists trying to learn about Indigenous people, come into Indigenous communities. And I think it was supposed to be like this experience for white people to see themselves in these, like, you know, people and try and get in on the programming that way. And it was a complete flop.
Like a first generation Queer Eye, but for... but for white settlers.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah, I think that's a good description. I'm like, and it didn't do great, I think. It was very controversial, and especially amongst Indigenous communities. They were like, why are you bringing these people here? So anyways, this is just to say that, like, I think while they've attempted to broaden their viewership, it makes sense to me that that hasn't been the most fruitful. And so instead, just forget about it and let's focus on giving really good, high quality content to the Indigenous people who do tune in and who we want to serve. I think it's the only way it becomes profitable in the long term, even if it isn't in the immediacy.
But even, I mean, I'm just speculating here, but if there's a way for growth here, and eventually in a not so distant future, hopefully, that non-Indigenous Canadians have also an interest for learning Indigenous languages. And so that even if you're focusing on Indigenous languages and having that available with subtitles as a language learning tool, ideally, that would not only interest Indigenous peoples. And so if there is space for growth, maybe that's the direction to grow.
Totally. And I think that this is where it branches out from just the media into, like, the government has to, as like the federal government and all the provincial governments, and Indigenous people have been calling for this for forever, has to put more money and power behind supporting Indigenous languages, not just for Indigenous people, but making it clear to Canadians writ large that Indigenous languages are important, they're worthwhile to learn, something that I think that they've largely very much failed to do. And so I see this as, like, perhaps more like what APTN's doing, I mean, at the language channel, more of a step towards meeting those policy goals than like the federal government has done in the last like 10 years, which is like pretty sad, but also certainly necessary.
Yeah, I cannot help to make a comparison to my own reality as somebody who's benefited immensely from the offer of programming in French in this country. And I know there's huge differences here, but the business argument that there's not enough of an audience to make certain kind of shows hasn't stopped, for example, TFO from existing in Ontario. Mm. It hasn't stopped, well, certainly in the Quebec media ecosystem to exist, but also for Radio-Canada to have small regional stations to service Francophone communities across the country. And so there's already a precedent in Canada for making a choice that languages matter. There's a way for us to create an environment where there is money behind keeping languages alive, and that Canada knows how to do this. And this is why I have such a strong accent. You know, so Canada knows how to do this.
Absolutely. And I think it's like one of those, if you build it, they will come things. In recent years, we've seen them dubbing Star Wars in Ojibwe, doing NHL coverage in Inuktitut and in all of these different languages. And they're well received and they're well viewed. Part of the argument of saying it's not profitable is because you've never invested in it and given people the opportunity to begin with. And so if you're going to build it long term, I think you'll be surprised also by how receptive people are to that and how much hunger is actually there.
This is a good exercise in opening up our imagination. You know, I'm thinking of New Zealand. I'm thinking of other countries in the world that have figured it out up to a certain point compared to Canada. And it seems that the fact that it's so difficult to find resources for people our generation who want to learn Indigenous languages to this day should not be an issue to that extent in Canada. And so the fact that APTN is trying to step in and fill that gap, I think is really good news. And we'll see how it goes. And we'll see if Gen Z, Gen Y actually gets cable.
That'll be a real win. If they can do that, impressive.
Riley, as you know, we like to duly note stories here on Shortcuts, so they don't fall through the cracks. Do you have something you'd like to duly note today?
I do, and it's a bit of a heavy one, but important, I think. It's the story of the 15-year-old from Samson Cree Nation who was fatally shot by two RCMP officers after calling and asking for help, saying that he was in danger, and then, you know, the danger actually came in the form of the Mounties. I think the thing that I am noting about this, because it is such a trend in the Canadian media, is that these stories, they've picked up now, for example, this story about this 15-year-old, but only after like Indigenous people had to scream online and say, why aren't we talking about this? Why isn't this the headline? That then the media can come back the next day or two and pick it up. And so there's this like real reactivity that is so frustrating. And I've seen it play out time and time again. The story is horrifying, but also, what the Canadian media? Sorry, I don't know if I can swear like that.
Yes, you can.
Okay, perfect. That is what I would like to be noted. I don't think Indigenous people's lives should be learning lessons, but when will they learn? It seems not anytime soon.
That's a really good point you're making. Thank you for that, Randy. Duly noted.
Emily, what is your duly noted for this week?
Now we're a year into Meta's ban on Canadian news. I think it's really interesting to look at what's happening in Brazil right now, where the Brazilian Supreme Court unanimously voted to uphold a decision by Justice Alexandre de Moraes, look at my Brazilian, to ban X in Brazil. To me, this is huge. And so it's not like Canadian news being banned by Meta. It's the other way around. It's the Brazil Supreme Court banning X from the Brazil market. To me, that will be something that I follow very closely because it can inform how other governments respond to the dumpster fire that has become X over the last little while and what we can do about it. Because I think in this day and age, it very much takes courage for any government to put some sort of limitations around social media platforms. They seem to don't think that government should tell them anything at all, then that they should be existing above any laws of any countries. And so how does X react? Obviously, there's been personal attacks from Elon Musk on the Brazilian government and the Supreme Court. Elon Musk has used his account to vilify the justice that rendered the decision as Brazil's Voldemort. And so it just says everything, first of all, about the level of debate that we're in.
No one has a tanty like Elon Musk, duly noted.
Can you imagine, right? You're a magazine and you get tons of backlash for an article about 8 women who have broken the glass ceiling. And in response, you choose to throw 3 of those 8 women under the bus and seemingly the author of your article. Well, that's what it sure looks like El Canada did here.
That was the voice of Rachel Gilmore, a journalist and TikToker, who was summarizing in her own words the El Canada fiasco that's been happening over the last week. It all started when Sadaf Ahsan wrote a piece from the September issue of El Canada. The trouble started when El posted the article on X, We were just talking about X, what a coincidence, and the mess it can sometimes be. So Elle posted the article on X with the description, over the past year, these 8 incredible Kenyan women have broken the glass ceiling, paving the way for those behind them. And the backlash was, let's say, swift would be a good word, and phenomenal. A lot of the response was transphobic, as 2 of the women who were included in that list are trans women. But there was also a backlash about another inclusion on the list, who is the Ontario MPP Sarah Gemma, who's been at the center of a lot of political turmoil and controversy over the last year. So following that online response, there's been a series of editorial changes to the article. And initially, these were made without editorial notes. So beginning on August 31st, the word women disappears from the subtitle of the article. And so now you just have those incredible Canadians and not Canadian women. The other major change that was made is that Sarah Gemma is not included anymore in the online version of the list. Obviously, they cannot do anything about print. And then after more online pressure, Elle added a cryptic disclaimer the next day, so on September 1st. And updated the disclaimer again on September 2nd and removed the author's byline from the article as well. Those disclaimers, we'll get to them in a minute. But first, Riley, have you been following this drama at Elle Canada, and what do you think is going on?
Ugh, I have been following it. What a show. I mean, I think all that we can say is going on is really like editorial and publisher cowardice and like keeling to like these factions of people. I'm sure they also were getting emails in addition to their, you know, just toxic comment sections and all of those things. But the thing that is so obviously frustrating about this is that like they are framing this now as like a move that they're making for everybody's safety, which is really weird. I know Sarah Gemma has come out to say like nobody's threatened me, so it's not for my safety.
Yeah, so just for everyone to follow what you're talking about. So in the disclaimers, one of the disclaimers says, due to threats issued, this article has been edited online by the publisher for the safety of everyone involved. You can read it in full in our September issue. And then to that, Sarah Gemma on X also said, I haven't received any threats, so it wasn't for my safety, with a laughing emoji, a cry laugh emoji. And there was also a second disclaimer published the next day on September 2nd that said, this original article represents the opinions of a political personality, but does not reflect the opinion of the publishers of Elle Canada and its parent company.
And yeah, the cry laugh emoji, how apt. I feel like also, I don't know, right? I don't know how it also makes these trans women any safer to take out the reference that they're women, like to keep them in all other ways, their face, their names, all these things, but just sort of agree with everybody in the terrible comment sections that were saying that these people aren't women, that these women aren't women. I think that this is really, again, a reactionary move on the part of like the publisher and the editors, and they're now seeing the fallout of like not thinking through any of these actions.
I'm gonna really hold on to that expression you just used, not thinking through, in a sense that Sarah Gemma is a person who's been standing for Palestinian rights, and that's what she was acknowledged for in this article. There's a lot of things she has said that have triggered a lot of controversy and backlash in the last year. The thing is, all of that is very easily Googleable. And so the people who included her in that list knew, or at least I very much hope they knew, they have all the pieces of information in front of them and decided to include her in that list. The same thing with including trans women as women, that was in no way something that was hidden as an information from them. It's not like they just realized that trans women are part of the list. And so it's not an editorial choice that there's a pressure because you didn't know, you knew exactly what you were doing. And so that's my issue with it. There's so many issues that we can take with this, but to me, the issue is you decide to do something, and then you just decide to not do it because you're afraid.
Mm.
That's what worries me, because there is going to be editorial decisions being made in this country for a whole bunch of reasons. but people not making editorial decisions based on their values, but rather making editorial decisions based on their fear, is something that is shifting to me in Canada. The fact that people are polarized in this country, that's also increasingly shifting. But that people are afraid to say, this is my editorial line, and this is what I think should be 8 Canadian women's being honored, but now I'm afraid of saying it. So I'm going to still publish it because there's the print edition, but then I'm going to appease the people on Twitter by making changes only for people who are essentially talking about it on Twitter. Like, that's my issue.
If there's no solid line, then it can be a slippery slope so quickly. The precedent it sets for not just L Canada, but editors and editorial decisions generally. And I think, like, this story that I keep coming back to, one of the things that is so ironic, I guess, is that, like, this is a story about women who essentially, like, they spoke truth to power. And, like, the reason that they're change makers is because they aren't afraid to stand against the masses, make unpopular decisions, fight against hate. And then the second that the publisher experiences even a fraction of what I know these women have faced, like, you know, for many years, they immediately, like, buckle and keel. I wonder if it's also has to do with the type of publication, like, that L Canada, I think, is most well known to be like a fashion magazine. Is there a different standard? I think there is more responsibility when you're starting to talk about social political issues, when you're trying to highlight historically marginalized groups of people. There's a specific set of ethics that I'm sure is different than when you're posting about and writing about fashion. And maybe perhaps they haven't done enough work also on the back end of things to figure out those lines for themselves. If they're not going to say trans women are women, if people are going to get mad about it, maybe say that from the outset, at least, so that, like, trans women know that they don't want to be featured in your story, or that writers don't want to work with you. There are a lot of really problematic publications out there, but the lack of transparency about it, I would be very frustrated, for example, if I was the author of that piece.
Right. And then we don't know how much of hate mail they've been receiving as well, directly or not. There's a lot that we don't know, because essentially it seems that people have been going into hiding mode. There has been a shift, for example, you know, once upon a time you had Teen Vogue in the US, and you have certain magazines who very much have a female audience, who have shifted tones in the recent years and tried to pick up the values of the generations that they want to espouse as a readership. And then you have a series of magazines in Canada that are still trying to find their identities. And so L Canada is now has the same editor-in-chief as L Quebec, and it's part of a consortium of a company of publication that is KAO Media, who's based in Montreal. And that cluster of women's magazine, it's really interesting how they've been soul-searching in terms of having sometimes a social message, but trying to make it so safe that you don't know if it's a social message. And not just them, in general, there's been a lot of magazines, I feel like they've been, for example, having those lists of change makers, whatnot, but because they're trying to appease and appeal to everyone, they're basically putting forward names of people that are so consensual that they haven't actually changed anything in society. Like, it's trying to basically co-opt the term change maker, but rid it of its substance. You're trying to stay out of controversy because at the end of the day, you're also selling, you know, either fashion or beauty products or whatnot. It's a business model much more than it is just a regular publication. And so trying to balance these two things, it seems to be something that they're struggling with. And in that, they seem to be throwing either themselves under the bus or making some choices but not having thought through those choices, and then endangering their team and not making the people they feature even knowing what they're embarking on as they accept to be featured.
Yeah, I mean, hear, and woof. That is, like, I'm seeing so many people thrown under the bus in this instance. I don't know what level this decision was made at. Was it just the editor? Was it, like, higher up execs? It reminds me a bit of the conversation we had earlier with APTN, where I'm like, there is a class of folks, powerful folks in the media, who I think are so out of touch or have such a rigid view of what is profitable and what is necessary that, like, I think they would have gotten, even if they got hate, they would have had a lot more respect and maybe more committed readership if they had kept Sarah Gemma in, if they had defended these trans women, if they had really stuck to their guns. But I think that there's a vision in their head of like, who buys our magazine? It's like middle-aged women at Shoppers Drug Mart, that like they were like, okay, no, we're going to pull it because of that. I have to imagine that, of course, that's a business decision. And there's just such a, yeah, like blinders on like what can be profitable beyond even what's ethical, because there's so many ethical faults here. But I think that it was also a really dumb business decision altogether.
Here's a suggestion on top of my head of perhaps a better way of navigating this in the future, because it will happen again, is maybe that everyone recognizes that online violence against women is violent.